Thank you for that, and welcome back to the show. Rick Tittle with you, coast to coast and around the world on the American Forces Radio Network. It is our pleasure to welcome to the show from the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, Dr. Edna Friedberg. She's here to talk about a very special event they had on Facebook with Ben Ferenc, who is the last living prosecutor from the Nuremberg trials. Dr. Friedberg, thanks for being with us. This is really fascinating to get Ben on, and I know he has been a part of the museum for some time. What exactly is going on over there?
Thanks for having me on today, Rick. I'm really glad to be here. Benjamin Ferenc, as you said, is the last living prosecutor from the post-war trials that happened in the aftermath of World War II in Nuremberg, Germany. He is 100 years old and going strong, both physically, mentally, and also in his commitment to justice and the power of the rule of law to forge peace in place of war. And this morning we hosted a live discussion that people can see on the Holocaust Museum's Facebook page with Ben, a wide-ranging conversation about how he grew up poor in Hell's Kitchen in Manhattan and ended up at age 27 being the lead prosecutor in what was called the largest murder trial in history. The trial for the murders of innocent civilians, over 1 million of them, primarily in mass shootings. It was his first case. He was 27 years old.
It is an amazing story, and I almost feel like that, you know, we weren't, as a government, we weren't taking it seriously enough not to send our most experienced, but this is why this guy triumphed so much. But, you know, as a history guy myself, and being overseas, and I've been to your museum, it's an amazing place, but this is a guy that looked Hermann Göring and General Keitel and Albert Speer in the eye before, you know, Göring killed himself and Keitel was hanged and Speer went to prison. It's amazing that we can talk to a guy who looked these accusers in the face. It's fascinating.
Yeah. I mean, Ben Ferenc, it was really a matter of being the right person in the right place. He had served in not very high-level positions in the U.S. Army during the course of the war. And at the end of the war, because he had been a student at Harvard Law School, as I mentioned, he came from a not very wealthy background, and so he had to work his way through school, and he happened to be the research assistant to a professor who was an expert in war crimes. So he had this expertise, and in the last months of the war, the Allies sent him out on a really gruesome mission to collect and document the evidence of massive, massive atrocities. So he traveled with units that were liberating Nazi concentration camps. He sought justice not just for crimes of the Holocaust, but in the show this morning, and again, listeners can go hear it on the Facebook page of the Holocaust Museum. He describes how he personally tracked down mobs of German civilians who beat to death American airmen. These were American flyers who were shot down over Germany and then attacked by mobs. And he went and found their bodies in order to bring some measure of closure to their families, but also interrogated them and helped to bring some of them to justice, too. So his work far transcends Nuremberg and was much bigger in pursuit of justice and right on behalf of the American people, on behalf of the Jews of Europe, and on behalf of human values.
Why do you think that in today's world that there can be such a thing as a Holocaust denier? I myself walked through Dachau, what was left of it. It was a sickening thing, but it was something that I felt I had to do. I mean, all you need to do is read Night by Elie Wiesel. It's amazing to me, and stupidity doesn't even come into it, but how is it, do you think, that we still have such a thing as a Holocaust denier?
Yeah, I mean, Rick, you've made a lot of the points, and clearly you are both a history buff, but also someone who's not afraid to examine difficult and painful history. I always encourage people to examine the motive. What is behind someone's ludicrous claim or something that so clearly challenges what is documented truth? There is always an agenda. In the case of Holocaust denial, most frequently the agenda is anti-Semitism, hatred of Jews, and that the denier sees either denying the actual happening of the Holocaust, but in more cases, a slippery slope trying to minimize it, trying to say that the numbers are distorted, that the claims are not true. It's usually a way to do something like claim that Jews somehow falsely have profited from the idea of this myth, or to use it to attack the state of Israel. So usually there is a more contemporary political agenda, and it's disguised, it's cloaked in the guise of intellectual inquiry, but in fact it's driven by hate.
More questions for Dr. Edna Friedberg from the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. Ben Ferenc is quoted as saying, "Nuremberg taught me that creating a world of tolerance and compassion would be a long and arduous task. I also learned that if we did not devote ourselves to developing effective world law, the same cruel mentality that made the Holocaust possible might one day destroy the entire human race," end quote. Now, without getting too overboard or too political, the words tolerance and compassion we have not seen a lot in the last 4 years. We've seen the rise of a lot of white supremacy groups, a rise of anti-Semitism, and of course with systemic racism. But to me, how any American, I mean, I can kind of see how a Southerner wants to fly the stars and bars. I think it's stupid, but I don't know how any American can fly a swastika. How is it for, you know, the Anti-Defamation League and people like you when you see this rise in fascism again?
I think what you're looking at here is the basic essence of human nature. Human nature is really pretty immutable. It doesn't change that much, but the circumstances do. And a big part of the appeal of extremist movements and of eventually slipping into violent extremism has to do with a sense of belonging, of people who feel that they are marginalized or somehow disempowered and want simple answers, kind of an easy way out of what are complex societal problems. So someone who feels maybe economically left behind, they want someone to blame. They want a target for their anger, and they want to feel powerful. So I'm not a social psychologist. I don't play one on TV, but I have consulted over the 20-plus years that I've been with the Holocaust Museum with a number of them, and this is the basic kind of human impulses that are at play. It's a desire to attach yourself to something that feels grandiose or bigger than you are, and to do it by abusing and denigrating another group of people.
The other day, I just finished reading Eric Larson's book, In the Garden of Beasts, and about William Dodd becoming the ambassador to Germany in 1933, right when this was all starting to go down with Kristallnacht and other things, and the pushback that FDR would get from Americans saying, well, I mean, you know, maybe Germany's doing us a favor here because, you know, the Jews do run all, you know, they run all them. Just the same stereotypes, because we kind of think of it, I don't know, maybe in a naive way of it being a European thing, but it's not just a European thing, is it?
No, it's not. And that's a terrific book that you mentioned. We did actually a series of programs with Eric Larson about that. And it gets to the context that it's really important that we look back at this history, not with some sense of smug self-righteousness, but to look also with a really honest eye at the failings of our own country. We have a special exhibition at the museum now, and in the time of COVID, people can find it online at ushmm.org. It's about Americans and the Holocaust. It's the story of us. It's more than about the FDR administration, but about the fact that, for example, the United States military at the time was only the 16th largest in the world. We were not the global policeman that we are used to thinking of ourselves as today. There was a very strong isolationist sentiment in 1930s America. People still really felt the wounds and the sting of the First World War, did not want to get involved in what they saw as domestic problems overseas. And as you said, also racism and anti-Semitism were quite open and institutionalized and formal in this country at the time. We had very, very strict and racially motivated anti-immigration quotas. And there was, for example, no refugee law or refugee policy in the United States. I can tell you as a historian, I didn't know this until maybe 6 or 7 years ago. That was not a category. If you were fleeing violence or persecution in your country of origin, the United States would give you in the 30s and 40s no special consideration. You had to wait in line on country-by-country quota lines, and those lines lasted for years, which in the case of most European Jews would amounted to a death sentence. So our country had closed doors. The United States Congress couldn't even get out of committee a bill that would have allowed 10,000 children, 10,000 unaccompanied Jewish miners to come to this country because people said they would be a threat to their jobs, that they were an economic threat. And so those kids were abandoned. So it's not that the United States didn't recognize what was going on, but there was neither the political will nor the popular sentiment to get involved. We just did not care enough.
Mm-hmm. Last question for you. Even in 2020, I still think about all the items that were stolen out of Jewish households and synagogues and where we are in still getting some of those items back. And also, Mossad, are they still looking in South America, North America, Europe, wherever, for, you know, guards at Treblinka and some of these other places?
I can't speak to the Mossad question because I don't know. I'm a historian. I'm not an espionage expert, so I don't know what they're doing. I certainly have enjoyed a lot of movies about it. I think we all have revenge fantasies. But your question about property is very, very important. It's important both in terms of restitution for the thousands and thousands and thousands of survivor and survivor descendant families who had their businesses Aryanized, expropriated by the Nazi state, or who were in danger when they returned after the war to their homes in other countries in Europe and had to leave, but also in the way that we are losing eyewitnesses every day. Ben Ferenc, may he live and be well, is 100 years old, but every day we have fewer and fewer people for whom this is not history, but it is their life story, that they can give us personal accounts. And the kinds of objects, not just the ones that were stolen, but anyone that was around then, they are really the forensic evidence of these crimes. They are the silent witnesses. They are the knit dress that a mother lovingly made for her daughter and she wore in hiding in someone's house for 2 years. They are the forged document that was life-saving and enabled someone to pass as a non-Jewish individual and therefore save his life. So we really believe very, very strongly that the heart of our museum and our mission is our collections, what I think of as the crime lab of the biggest crime ever committed. And so much of the evidence is created by the perpetrators themselves. And that brings me back in closing to Benjamin Ferenc, because it was people like Ben and his team who scoured Europe looking for this documentary evidence that gives irrefutable proof that not only did these crimes happen, but the people who committed and orchestrated them were proud of it and made sure to record it.
Make sure to check out the museum's Facebook page for more of that. We've been speaking with Dr. Edna Friedberg of the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. You do great work there. As I said, I've been to the museum. It's a triumph. And so thank you for everything that you do. And it was great having you on the show today.
Thank you so much. And we are open in limited numbers. If anyone is in D.C., you can get timed passes even in the time of COVID. And when things reopen, Rick, if you're ever in D.C., please look me up. Be glad to see you.
I definitely will. Thank you, Dr. Friedberg. I'm Rick Tuttle. We'll take a quick break. Come on back on Sports Byline.